We ask for this, I say ask, but we really demand it for our employees, like, have fun. Because if you're not having fun, your food tastes shitty, your service is terrible, the atmosphere is heavy. It's got to be fun in there somewhere. So it sounds hollow, but that really is the litmus test. We kind of like recalibrate very frequently to make sure that we're still having a good time. Because if we're not, like, get out. It's way too hard.
Yeah,
you know?
Then why are you doing it?
Yeah, it's way, way too hard.
Hey there, welcome to episode 86 of Audacious Food Talk for Gluttons. This is your host, Janae Libby. Welcome to Audacious, where food is just the starting point for many, many deeper conversations on life, love, success. Why are we even here? Yeah, we talk about that sometimes. Thanks for being my guest today. I do this for connection. I want to talk with folks rather than about them online. There are thousands and thousands of food folks out there doing the work of food. I'm trying to get away from the artifact of the pretty plate, the finished product that you see on Instagram, and back to the people who labor in our kitchens, our fields, our stores, our boardrooms, people who are audacious about what they do. How do we include everyone in the conversation? You can find me on iTunes. The website is audacious.co because .com is still for sale. In today's bonus episode, yes, it's a bonus episode. I actually recorded a bunch of shit at Fireflower and Fork. I did. I had my little Ferrari Zoom with the big fuzzy on it, and I was sticking it in everybody's face and asking them questions, whether they wanted to answer them or not. I'm new to this. I'm new to the ambient recording. So I was trying to kind of play around and figure it out, and just, it's fun. You know, when you're an artist, even if you're not an artist, it's nice to engage that side of you, that creative side, and let go of expectations. Don't worry about being successful. Don't be afraid of failure. Try stuff. Play around. I played around with the recorder at Fireflower and Fork, and in today's episode, it is the Women in Food panel. I moderated this panel with Carrie Diamond of Cherry Bomb and Radio Cherry Bomb, which is part of the Heritage Radio Network in Brooklyn, New York. Kristen Kish, she is the season 10 winner of Top Chef. Chef Joy Crump of Food and Mercantile in Fredericksburg, Virginia. And Jessica Wilson, Chef of Grace, which will soon make its appearance in Chimborazo in Richmond, Virginia. If you are a native Richmonder or live there, you know the Chimborazo neighborhood is right there near Libby Hill. They filmed Lincoln there. It's part of Church Hill. It's a beautiful part of the city. For many, many years, it was not the safest part of the city to go to. And I'm just thrilled to see it coming back and to see people moving in. I heard a rumor that even Daniel Day-Lewis owns a brownstone in Chimborazo now. How about that? That's pretty cool. Before we get to today's talk, I do have a few things I'd like to mention. I saw a post the other day that Foggy Ridge Cider is officially closing its cider production facility. Now, it will still be growing apples, cider apples, not eating apples, but cider apples, for our area cideries. If you have listened to any of my cider episodes, including the one with Diane Flint of Foggy Ridge Cider, you know that cider apples are a lot smaller, a lot harder. They are very tart. You really don't want to eat them, but they are an important part of cider production. And sadly, Diane has decided that her Final Call part brand of cider, she has several different varieties, and the last one that will come off the line is called Final Call, appropriately enough. That will be the last one, but she is going to continue to grow apples. She will continue to rent out the garden cottage in Dougspur on the orchard property. If you listen to my episode with Jake Bushing a few weeks ago, you know that I recorded at the garden cottage in Dougspur, and it is heaven on earth. I urge you, take a week for yourself, take a few days, take a weekend, and go to Foggy Ridge Cider, stay in the garden cottage, walk the grounds, look at the orchard. It's pretty even in winter. I am already planning a trip back to Dougspur. So sadly, cider production is finished, but the apples will continue to be grown. And thank you, Diane, for your championing of Virginia cider apples. You were the first. You were the first one to step in and say, let's make this happen. The minute I met her at the Appalachian Food Summit, I knew she would be a friend. I knew I would have her on the podcast. She is a font of information, and we are so grateful for all the delicious cider that came out of Foggy Ridge. I also want to give a quick shout out to Sarah and Tim Gorman of Cardinal Point Winery. They have been on the podcast. They were maybe a few months ago I had them on the podcast. This past weekend was the Oyster Roast, the 14th annual Oyster Roast. My husband and I are wimps, so we stayed home on Saturday because I think it was a high of 22. Ridiculous. We went yesterday, Sunday, and it was fantastic. They had the fire pit going, live music. We sat in the tent and finished off a bottle of the A6. Oh boy, is that good. And it tasted so good with the oysters. We had them raw, we had them fried, had a baguette. Such a nice minerality to that wine. They say peaches, but I taste salt water. I taste minerals. I taste like water dripping on rocks. It was very clear and crisp and so good with the oysters. So head out to Cardinal Point, try all of their wines. And boy, if you miss the oyster roast, you really missed a good event. That's a great, great food event. And thank you, Tim and Sarah, for having me and the hubby out there yesterday. All right, let's get to the interview, shall we? Without further ado, I'm going to try and not ramble as much as I usually do. I do want to thank Teej.fm, the WTJU Podcast Collaborative, for making me a part of their community. And I also want to thank listeners like you who went to patreon.com/audaciouspod and offered up their support for this very podcast. For as little as a dollar a month, you can support our community, our food community, and make sure that I keep growing. I would like to have a radio network like Carrie Diamond of Cherry Bomb. Let's work toward that, shall we? For as little as a dollar a month. Check out patreon.com/audaciouspod. And you know those billboards that say your business here that you see on the highway? Well, this is the spot where I would put your business. Do you have a food event coming up? It is the holidays. There's a lot of cooking classes, there's a lot of tastings, cookie swaps, all that kind of stuff. Would you like to have your event announced on Audacious for $25 only, introductory price? You can advertise with me, Janae Libby of Audacious Food Talk for Gluttons. Tweet me at AudaciousPod or send an email, contact@audacious.co, and I will get you set up. Okay, today's interview is with the Women in Food panel. I was so honored to talk to these women. And yes, I was nervous. I have never spoken with women of this caliber. And interestingly enough, the only thing I recall about this talk, it's all kind of a blur. I looked down at my questions about the third of the way through and thought to myself, these are all wrong. So the remainder of the interview was literally me riffing. I came up with questions on the fly because the ones I pre-wrote were just not good enough for these ladies. I'm so honored to have talked with them. Did I fumfer? I feel like I did. You be the judge. Let me know. All right, see you on the flip side. Enjoy.
Joint Compass Parking, if you know, in this part of the world, it's a little tricky. I'm from Richmond, so I'm coming back here. I'm like, oh yeah, parking is always a challenge. My name is Janae Libby. I am a podcaster in Charlottesville, Virginia. My podcast is called Audacious Food Talk for Gluttons. And when I was asked to do this panel, I was thrilled because this is what I do every day. I sit with people who do the work of food and talk about their journey, their story. Why do they have such a passion for food? What was their training? What are their challenges? What are their obstacles? And before we get started, I do have a few housekeeping things that I have to do. I want to mention that the sponsor for the Women in Food panel today is Virginia Is for Lovers. Love is love. And Wolf Gourmet. It's presented by Real Richmond Food Tours. And our guests are the co-founder of Cherry Bomb Magazine, Carrie Diamond, the winner of Top Chef Season 10, Kristen Fish, Fredericksburg Chef of Food, Joy Crump.
Yes.
Welcome, Joy. Come on in.
So embarrassing.
Oh, I love parking. I love it. I was just explaining to them, I'm from Richmond, so yeah. I'm like, oh yeah, she's having trouble.
Is this really happening? Okay, cool. Sorry.
And Chef Jessica Wilson, who will be opening Grace in Churchill, formerly of New York. I have to say, Jessica just showed me a picture of her with Julia Child, who was a teacher.
Teachers in culinary school years ago.
Yeah. That was thrilling. And I do want to introduce each guest just a little bit before we get started. I have a set of questions, but like I told our ladies, I prefer to do this organically and just to see where we go, and we will have time at the end for questions, as always. So our first guest, Carrie Diamond. She is the co-founder of Cherry Bomb, an independent biannual magazine examining the inexplicably intertwined worlds of food and fashion, and host of the weekly radio Cherry Bomb podcast. As an aside, I can't think of a better place to be doing this talk because I just walked through the fashion exhibit here at the Valentine. It's perfect. Carrie has worked for Women's Wear Daily, Harper's Bazaar, Lancome, and Coach, just to name a few. And after falling in love with the chef, she helped him open 3 restaurants, all in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn. Cherry Bomb the Cookbook is a collection of recipes and stories from 100 of the most creative and inspiring women in food today. Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you.
Our next guest, Kristen Kish, was born in Seoul, South Korea, adopted at the age of 4 months, and she grew up in Michigan. After attending Le Cordon Bleu in Chicago, she worked for Michelin star chef Guy Martin of Le Grand Beaufort at his Boston restaurant. She then worked for Barbara Lynch in Boston, first at Stir and then at Menton. Barbara became a mentor, suggesting she might want to audition for Top Chef. She did, winning season 10. Kristen has co-hosted the series 36 Hours on the Travel Channel, and her first cookbook, Kristen Kish Cooking, is a celebration of her taste buds, focusing on classic techniques. As she says, once you know the basics, from braising to pickling, smoking to searing, you can bend them to your will. Welcome, Kristen. Joy Crump, our next guest, is the co-owner and executive chef of Food and Mercantile in Fredericksburg, Virginia. She's a graduate of the Art Institute of Atlanta's Culinary Arts Program. Joy specializes in researching and preparing locally grown and organic foods. Her career began in Los Angeles working as the caterer and event planner for the president of Capitol Records, and at the same time she worked on private events for Warner Brothers Television. In 2005, Joy relocated to Atlanta where she studied under Chef Bradley Rouse, head chef for the Atlanta Hawks, while working on her degree. And after graduation, Joy began cooking at Woodfire Grill as an apprentice to Chef Michael Tuohy. Joy appeared on season 12 of Top Chef last fall, and her signature chicken and waffles won the Virginia Is for Lovers Culinary Madness Challenge in April. Welcome, Joy. Jessica Wilson. Jessica has worked with, been taught by, and been inspired and motivated by chefs such as Julia Child, Gabrielle Hamilton, Missy Robbins, and I'm going to mispronounce this, Joe Yakubian. She's always been surrounded by the culinary arts, from her early years growing up on a farm in Vermont to working with culinary historians to foraging on morning walks to her first job as a dishwasher at age 14. Wilson's 2-decade career has taken her from Vermont to Florida to Massachusetts and on to success in the East Village and Brooklyn in New York. Her resume includes time at Prune and Alvace, and most recently turns as executive chef at Goat Town and the Michelin-recommended Dear Bushwick. Jessica is now poised to open Grace in Richmond, a neighborhood garden-to-table restaurant with an emphasis on fresh, sustainable, local, and affordable. The green space of the double lot will be a seasonal garden, providing for the restaurant and a morning community market. Welcome, Jessica. All right, so the topic is women and food. And as a podcaster, I always find that the first question is the hardest to come up with. I've been thinking about it a lot, and I actually came up with it during Gabrielle's talk this morning with Carrie Diamond. And it's from her book, Blood, Bones, and Butter, Gabrielle Hamilton's book, her memoir about cooking. I've just described four chefs and all the work that they have done. And in Blood, Bones, and Butter, Gabrielle talks about the fact that women chefs oftentimes don't just have one job, they have two. The first job is as a chef. The second job is to kind of look at the kitchen they're in, how to navigate it. How do I navigate this kitchen? Do I have to act this way or can I act this way as a woman? So that's, I guess my question is, do you think you have two jobs when you're in a kitchen?
You have more than two jobs.
That's a bad way of saying.
I'm like two.
As a female, do you find that in addition to all the jobs you have in a kitchen, is there that unspoken, subtle thing like, okay, I've got this job too. Is it okay to swear? Do I not swear? Do I act like a girly girl to get him to, finish his mise en place, or can I just tell him to do it and he'll do it? Like a gender thing. I found that very interesting in her book.
I mean, for me it's different because at this point I'm mostly focused on Cherry. I'm pretty much focused on Cherry Bomb 110% of the time. And it's all women. So that's my universe right now. And I'm not a chef. I write about chefs and celebrate chefs in other ways. But I don't, we get asked a lot about the women in food question, and we do a lot of panels like this. I often would say, there really isn't a difference. You're a chef first. But I do, the more and more conversations we have about the restaurant industry right now and how the restaurant model is kind of broken, you and I were just talking about it in the room earlier, whether it's wage, quality of life, childcare, pick your topic, I do think women think about these things a little bit differently. And I think you have restaurant culture that men ran for hundreds of, over 100 years easily. And that's where we are today. And things need to change. And I do think the change will start with women in this industry right now. But in the heat of things in the kitchen, from what I've observed, I don't think men or women approach that differently. But
no,
we do have three chefs here. So.
I totally agree. But I also think it's about how we're just going to conquer that day, that service, how getting all those people to be on the same page, how you're going to do to execute your food properly, time efficient, about the product to, yeah, there is probably a little bit of that, but I think it's definitely like, how am I going to kick ass today, So I don't know if it has to do too much about how I'm going to do my day, depending on my gender.
Like, I struggle, we get asked this question quite a bit, and it's like, how do you answer it? And I don't know how to answer it because I don't really know. Because if my cooks are like, hey, I don't want to do this because you're a woman, like, you're going to get fired.
Yeah.
So who knows if someone wants to listen to me or not, if it's based on my gender or based on my ability to lead a team and if they vibe with that. At the end of the day, they're there, they're working, they understand that I'm the chef and I'm the boss. And if they don't like it, they can go. I think I forget that I'm a woman in the kitchen. I think that my staff forgets that I'm a woman in the kitchen because at the end of the day, our goal is to provide a product and a service to the people coming in. And regardless of gender, we all take pride in our work. And I think that's the main goal that we focus on.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, I feel similarly, like, I'm the boss in my kitchen, so there really isn't, the hierarchy is sort of, it's already framed out, and it's, you know, doesn't have much to do with my gender, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just, it's my kitchen, and you have to do what I say. But I do think there, I remember when I was coming up in kitchens, I remember there being a distinct energy difference between a woman-run kitchen and a male-run kitchen, mm-hmm. and I know that I consciously made an effort. I gravitated towards that energy of a female-run kitchen. I liked it more. It was more collaborative. The intensity was more about the product and not the personality dynamics. It was, you know, not a constant stating of who's in charge. It was, do you know what I'm saying? So there's that. But I think that the things that are inherently female, to me, that I struggle with or that I'm conscious of, are the things that come into play when I'm managing.
Sure.
You know, like balancing sort of like a nurturing tendency. How do I do that without being a pushover? You know, those are the things that I struggle with as a manager, as my responsibilities grow, as I'm trying to get a larger group of people to drink my Kool-Aid, you know, to mm-hmm. kind of get in line behind me. Mm-hmm. That's, yeah.
That's interesting. And I'm wondering, when you were asked to be on a women in food panel, did you go, oh my God, not again, really? We're going to do this again. Like, what was your reaction?
Well, this is my first, so no. I mean, there's always that, okay, what are we, like, are we going to talk about the same thing again? However, I think depending on who you're sitting up and speaking with in the conversation, where it goes, is all dependent on, obviously, all of the humans. And so, therefore, you know, the overarching theme, yeah, I mean, we all talk about it, but what each individual person can bring and what their standpoint and their views are fantastically unique.
Yes.
I also think the harassment issue, you know, that recently came to light between Harvey Weinstein and John Besh down in New Orleans, and that's, there's going to be more, we all know that. I think that has given women in food panels a different tone and a different thing to talk about, because going back, you know, to the original question and what you said, Kristen, when you're in the kitchen, you know, you're a chef and, you know, there's a job and it's not based on you being a man or a woman. I think you can't, the harassment issue has sort of forced us all to remember there are differences in the kitchen, and a lot of us have been subject to things that a guy just never will be subject to, although guys are harassed in kitchens also, I think.
Yeah, and probably we are now handling more things and juggling more, so now it's, we have another thing we also have mm-hmm. to pay attention to and be aware of, and also teach to the other, you know, or other folks who are female as well.
You know, what's interesting too is as the role of a chef has become much greater than just being in the back of the house, like we get asked to do different photo shoots and different sponsorships and branding and all that, there was this instance where, and it's always in the back of my head. So women's health was doing like this celebrate your body or like naked issue or something. So they were like, would you be interested? And I immediately was like, absolutely not. I can't. And I know that what they're doing is celebrating, you know, a woman's figure and like different forms and all that kind of thing. And it's quite beautiful. But I was like, I have to walk into a kitchen after this.
Right.
And if I'm surrounded by boys, like we're gonna have a problem, and I'm not gonna get that same respect. Now, I mean, so in that sense, yeah, being a woman, obviously. I mean, if some male chef did it, they'd be like, yeah, chef, like, cool, whatever.
They'd say that to you, too.
That's an interesting point. I never, like, image. Like, there is an image of the male chef. If you close your eyes and you think of it, there's definitely a trend. You know, they've got a beard, they've got tattoos, they might be wearing, you know, vintage-looking boots. Like, is that the same for women chefs? I don't know that it is. Like, if I'm thinking, and it's stupid, man chef, women chef, anyway, because you guys are doing the same work. It's a ridiculous question. But there is that question of image. Would they have asked a guy to do that?
Well, I mean, there's a big problem in media. I mean, again, we were talking about this walking downstairs. You don't see women over a certain age in the food world represented necessarily in the food media. There are a handful of women like Ina Garten, you know, the home chef. It's more acceptable for the home chef, the famous home chef, to age slightly and maybe you know, not be a certain weight, not look a certain way. But good luck as a female chef. Like, the older you get, the harder it is for you to get the media attention. There's a lot of ageism and looksism that goes on in the food media. And, you know, we try to battle that in Cherry Bomb. Like, we have all ages, all everything in the magazine. And it is a bummer. Like, we were talking about a friend who's a restaurateur, like, wildly successful, and somebody who should just be a model for so many people who aspire to get into this industry. And she has a restaurant group in the middle of the country, and she went to see a big editor-in-chief, and she said, I knew the second he met me and saw that I was, like, over 60, I was done. Mm-hmm. And that happens. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we did a panel in New York, Women in Food panel, I do a lot of them. And someone asked about the pressure to look a certain way in the food media. And, you know, you look at a guy like Action Bronson, you will never have a woman who looks like Action Bronson. Ever. Ever. And it is kind of funny, but it's like not at the same time because it's just not fair. You know, you see the same thing with talking heads on, like, news programs. You know, guys just get away with being able to look a certain way
and
that women will never in a million years be.
And also eating that way. I mean, there's like constant like that. That's not what we want to promote. Gluttonously, and you also can look, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of things that just are not fair.
Right. I'm thinking the cupcaking of food, like the Pinteresting of food. Like, yeah, you have Action Bronson on this side, and then on the other side, oh, let's make a cake in a mug, and then we'll go cuddle a goat, and then we'll go forage for whatever, for wildflowers, and have a perfect house, and that kind of thing, too. So, yeah, just got a lot to think about. I want to go back to the John Besh thing briefly, because I, as a podcaster, I used to work in food. In various roles, and I've experienced harassment on the job. I get different reactions when I speak with men and women about this issue. Not always. Men seem to say, well, you know, the allegations are. And when I speak with women, they're like, oh, yeah, no, he's guilty. I know you. I mean, I spoke with a podcaster recently, and he was kind of brushing it away, and I'm like, listen, the journalists researched this for 8 months.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm thinking maybe
Brett, who wrote the
there's
story.
Something
yeah.
there.
It's, I mean, it's a lot of women. It's not just
It's not just one.
That's enough, but there's even more.
And my question is kind of twofold. Have you seen a change in the culture of the kitchen over the years that you've worked, or in the industry that you've worked? And what systems do you have in place at your job to prevent this sort of thing from happening, because he did not have an HR guy, which
well,
is I could not believe.
Like that, given
the size
of his
bananas,
place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, again, I put my policies in place so you know, in our employee handbook, we have a non-sexual harassment policy, zero tolerance, etc. But when that happened, when we heard about John Besh, you know, the first thing that my business partner and I did, she's a woman as well, is we took that policy and we highlighted it, and it was like, you know, zero tolerance, and we won't be, but then we went, hey guys, here's what this means, you know, and we sent out like a company-wide email to everyone. It means no talking nasty, no touching, no thinking about touching, no saying nice sweater while you're eating a banana, like, don't use your brain, and if you are a manager and you witness those things, and you don't do something about it, and you don't put it in writing, you are fired. If you witness it and you say nothing, you are fired. And so I think that, A, creating the culture is something that we can do, and we've taken it upon ourselves as we have our own kitchens or even work in kitchens or create our own, you know, groups, A. But B, I think it's easier to have conversations like this when we're with a room full of women, because who doesn't agree that those things are horrible and need to change? The change comes when you involve men in the conversation. You know, when you tell the ones who are being gross that this is gross, and when you tell the ones who are not, good job, t- tell the other one to knock it off. You know, like that's the way I think that you start to move. And it's like things are moving not just in our industry, but in all industries, like new iPhones. Like it's hard to keep up with what a chef looks like and what the trends are because they're changing so fast. But the conversation has started, and I don't think there's any way to quiet it at this point.
No,
that's good. I've been impressed with the chefs in my town of Charlottesville that came forward unprompted and said, "Hey, guys, this is not okay. You know, we don't do this in our kitchen." So yeah, I definitely want to mention that. I want to switch topics a little bit. Kristen and Carrie both have cookbooks out, and I have noticed as a food writer a lot more story in cookbooks lately. Like, it's not just here's recipes. I'm thinking of Vivian Howard's book that came out last year. Every recipe, there was a story. Where did it come from? Why does she make it? Why is it important? Is that trend here to stay? Why did it happen?
Our publisher was like, "You have to have less stories." Well, because we had 100 different people, and you know, Chair Bomb's all about storytelling, and we started the magazine because we just loved women like, you know, the three of you, and felt there needed to be another outlet, you know, to tell more stories. But everybody knows what a head note is. I learned what a head note is. It's the story above the recipe. And I got really into it for like the first 10 recipes, and was just like writing, and had fun interviewing people. And I turned in the first batch, and my editor's like, "Oh no, she's like 100 words maybe." But I have noticed what you're talking about. Vivian's book, Deep Run Roots, was so beautiful. And Missy Robbins, who you worked for.
I haven't seen that yet.
There's a lot of storytelling in Missy's, and I was like, "How the hell do you get away with that?" I was like, "Oh, I'm allowed to do that." You've got your great, you know, intro.
Yeah.
And
we read, yeah. Like, the intro is obviously, like, our moment to give you, if you don't know who we are or whatever, this is where we lay it all out for you. And so, you know, although it's important to talk about, you know, it was great to talk about Top Chef and all that kind of stuff, but it was also really important to start from the very beginning and navigate, like, the goods and the bads. And, like, my life has not been perfect, and I struggled a lot with a lot of things. And then where it's kind of come from, because I believe when you understand the cook, you understand the food a lot better. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I could tell you a recipe dish, and then I can tell you exactly where it came from and give you that story. And whether you relate to it or not, it's gonna make the food taste better. Mm-hmm. Like, I know, like, every time a course goes out, I'm gonna go out and explain it, and I'm gonna give you a piece of me, because the food is food. Like, we all think of good food. But it's a story that brings it to this whole nother level, where all of a sudden you're like, "Oh, and now you understand." And it becomes more personal. Food needs to become more personal. Absolutely.
That's why we resisted doing a cookbook for a long time, because I was like, we're here to celebrate other people, not like, our own cookbook. And but I worked in digital media for a little while and got so frustrated by these websites like All Recipes and whatnot. I mean, how many recipes are online? Like a million plus, and you don't know what's good about this recipe versus another recipe. So when we solicited recipes from all these different chefs, we did ask for a recipe that had something meaningful behind it. Because I was like, if I'm gonna put all this time into making this stew or this banana bread or this whatever, I want to know what's behind it. And I like that idea of being in the kitchen and sort of like what you said when you come out of the kitchen, like being in the kitchen and knowing like there's more to this than just the ingredients that I'm throwing in the pot. You know, this recipe came from this person's great grandmother who came here from Mexico or who did this. And I think it makes you feel a little less alone in the kitchen in a weird way when you're in there cooking and you know the story behind what you're making.
Why do each of you enjoy food and cooking so much? Like, why is it such a passion for you? Or maybe your favorite thing to do in the kitchen? That always interests me. Like, going back to, I just listened to Gabrielle talk for an hour this morning. She loves cleaning out the walk-in. Like, she loves scrubbing it. It's like her favorite thing to leave the restaurant. Yeah. Everything's in order. It's clean. I would hate that. What is y'all's passion when it comes to cooking?
I'm sure that I'm not unique in that it sort of everything kind of ties back to my family and the times that we spent together, and that's the way that we showed each other love. And my family was separated. My parents were divorced when I was very young, So I had half my family here and half there, and so getting together always meant eating, and it was just sort of a symbol of, I don't know, something that was to be celebrated, you know? So like dinner was to be celebrated, or a birthday was to be celebrated, and it all happened around food. So that is always in the back of my mind. It's to make someone remember something that gave them pleasure or joy or love, and then also to try and give them an experience that's new, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's, and it's just everybody's lowest common denominator, food.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Right.
I think also, I fell in love with cooking because I, one, like I enjoyed it, but I also, that's what I feel like I'm good at. And so there's not a lot of things in the world that I grew up thinking, oh, I'm really good at something. But when I found cooking, I was like, oh my God, I actually have, I have something. And I enjoy it and I want to share it. So yeah, like food is love, and that's how we kind of, that's our love language, right? Mm-hmm. My favorite thing to do is cook for other people. I hate cooking for myself. But it was truly like a moment where I was like, I can actually be good at something. And then running with that little seed.
I both Joy and Kristen, I mean, that's definitely why I do it. I mean, I love what I do. I even love it for the rawness and the realness of it, and where you can just kind of not be anything. You can just be at that moment, and whatever you put in your, like, my heart is probably the best part about cooking, is putting that out there and then into that and then taking it from there. So I agree with both of you.
Do you guys ever have young chefs come and ask you for advice?
They are young chefs.
People just starting out. Like, maybe they just graduated culinary school, or they're thinking about going. If they did come up and ask, what piece of advice would you give them?
Yeah, we get that question a lot, right? Yeah. I mean, I'm sure everyone has gotten somebody reaching out. And the piece of advice that I wish I had gotten was to, one, humble yourself. I was a little brat, and I fully admit that. And I had expectations and kind of like this sense of like entitlement. And I wish someone said, enjoy those 8 hours while you peel carrots. Listen to the buzz of the kitchen. Understand what it's about. And especially now with food and chefs and TV, and it just looks like it's so bright and shiny, is you kind of have to remember, again, to bring yourself down and say, okay, yeah, although, you know, you see these people, they've also worked their asses off to get there, and they've put in their time. And it's kind of taking the time to learn what kind of person and chef you want to be, as opposed to trying to emulate somebody else. Because I think, we need more of everyone else's individual stories as opposed to everyone trying to compete with each other on the same level, in a sense.
Yes.
Support. Yes.
Yeah. And to learn, I just constantly learn, take as much as you can, because every day, I mean, this field is just constant of growing and learning and tasting and enjoying more.
And a question for Carrie. When you were putting the cookbook together, mm-hmm. were there any surprising aspects about the contributors? Like, you're like, oh, okay.
Everything was a surprise.
Yeah. Because, yeah, it's a wide range of folks.
Cookbooks are not easy, but they're great when they finally are done and they come out and they're like, oh, look at that beautiful cookbook. But the process is brutal, and I sort of had no idea. And then we compounded the brutality by asking 100 different people to give us recipes. And what you learn very quickly is a recipe is very much like a fingerprint or a language. Everyone's are different. And they write their recipes different, and they approach their recipes differently. And some people are restaurant chefs, some are home cooks, some, and you know, Cherry Bomb, we like to celebrate a mix of people who have kind of found their way into this industry, whether it's the food stylist or the food photographer or the food writer or the Instagrammer or the chef or whatnot. So it's really fascinating. I've come to decide that it's almost cruel to ask the restaurant chef for a recipe for a home cook, because that's just not how you guys cook. You know, like you're
right.
So like 4 days prior.
Yeah. So we had a few restaurant cooks who forgot to they changed some of the quantities, but they forgot to change other quantities, and they're like, I swear this was a crab cake, not a crab soup, but this is really coming out like a crab soup, and then you realize the quantities weren't scaled, you know, the right way. But it was fun. We tested everything. One thing I didn't realize is some people hire recipe testers. That's a whole job now. And we didn't want to do that because I wanted us to be able to vouch for every recipe that was in there. You know, because we're on social media all the time. I don't want somebody to be like, hey, listen, that recipe sucks. And I wanted to be able to say, hey, well, I made it and I can walk you through it from a civilian perspective. And also the team, you know, we all have modest kitchens. Most of us live in studios in New York City. And, you know, yeah, I have a Vitamix and a nice knife, but I don't have a fancy kitchen setup beyond that. So we also wanted to show that just anybody could really make these recipes. There are probably like three in there that you probably shouldn't try unless you're really crazy. You'll figure out which one of those are.
Quickly. Well, and that's actually a good question for the three chefs on the panel. How do you develop recipes in your restaurant? Is it a team process, individual? Do you come up with something and say, hey, try this. Is it good? I think it's good. What do you think? I mean, how do you guys
go
about that?
Well, for me, it's just usually myself, unless I have some people that have been there for a long amount of time that I want to incorporate their, you know, thought process as well. But I don't do any taste testing on any of my recipes. I create in my mind and then write a list and then I do diagrams and then I execute. So my process is a little different than most. So,
and what are the diagrams?
Usually plating or how I would like it to look and layers and, yeah. Looks kind of like, you know, what was the, when we were younger, we do, we'll start with the middle and then we would do little branches and like that. So it looks like that.
Cool.
I think Coggle is a website that does that now. Huh. Coggle, you can go on and start a balloon and then just keep going from there.
Oh, nice.
So,
cool.
Yeah.
And what about you guys? Like, how did you develop the recipes for your cookbook, Kristen?
Yeah, so again, first cookbook and like carrying lots of surprises, you're like, oh shit. But essentially, like, it all started with recipe titles, and probably about, I don't know, 75% of them, I'd never cooked before. They're all in my head. And so I wrote the recipe from my head, like cooking it in my mind. And obviously through a 3-year process, they get cooked and tested and all that kind of stuff, and you know, figure it all out. But there are just, I mean, there's just so many ideas that float in our brains at any given point that, I mean, you just had to pick and choose, you know, like, and I hate writing recipes, so writing a cookbook was like such an interesting process. But recipes, like, again, I think because we cook so instinctually, and when we lead our team and show somebody how to cook something, like, I know I'm a visual learner, and a lot of chefs are, that we walk through the process and we cook it all together. I don't just give them a recipe and say, oh, go cook this. We cook it together as a team, and that's our recipe. And then, you know, input, and I'll take anybody's opinions, certainly, and anybody's cookbook, you know, anybody that has something to add, because I think it's really, I need to feel like I'm my worst critic, right? And so I need so many different opinions to feel like it's actually good.
I always think like it has to be the way I want it to be when I'm not there doing it, you know? So I sort of work backwards from there. And then I know the layout of my kitchen. I know our volume. I know how many burners we have. I know that my saute chef is a little bit more skilled than my grill cook, and so that I take all those things into account, and then I go, okay, this is how I want this, you know, recipe to be or this dish to be, and it sort of has it changes throughout the year because my staff changes throughout the years, but really what I do is I start with the end in mind, and I do just hand my chefs, like, I go the opposite way, I just hand them the recipe, and then when I look at what they've come up with, I'm like, what is that? And I sort of realized that, okay, that part was still in my head. I didn't say anything. And so then it helps me rewrite the recipes because, again, I'm trying to create a full picture when I'm not standing there going, what is that? You know? So I really, like, the first draft is what I think it's supposed to be, and the second draft is really the one that works because that's the one where the chefs who are cooking it go, this is what I thought you meant, you know, and I can see how I messed up or how I need to reinterpret what I thought I said.
Right.
So that's the process for us. And then after that, we burn, you know.
Yeah. Cool. All right, one more question, and then I want to open it up to the audience here. This is something I ask all of my guests. What are your core values and goals for you and your business? When you get up in the morning, what are the things that you're constantly reminding yourself when you wake up and go to work? Like, why do you do this? Like, what's the value? What are you trying to do? What's your purpose? Hard question.
Good question.
Yeah.
I mean, I can answer that. I do think about that all the time. For us, it's so funny when you introduce us, and we did start out sort of like the intersection of food and fashion. That was like a big thing when Cherry Bomb started. But our mission now is 100% like advancing the cause of women and feminism. And I'm super unapologetic about that. And the election, you know, was so depressing. We shot the Martha Stewart cover the day after the election.
Really?
The morning after the election. I went to bed early because I thought, you know, I just thought I knew how it was going to turn out. And then so the next morning we were just like all in. And it was very depressing, but it made me double down on our mission. And I was like, we have a mission, we have a cause. We just redid our website. We were able to put a mission statement on there, which was very gratifying. And it's that I wake up every day 100% committed to that. And just when I think like it's getting better, it's like, you know, two steps forward, 10 steps back, you have things like John Besh and all of that, and you realize that there's just so much more work that remains to be done, but we're here and we're committed to it, so.
But that's a perfect statement, committed to it. I think that's what I definitely, just staying committed to yourself and to your vision and to the people that are coming to eat your food or what your, you know, expression of what you want to put out there. So yeah, I think committed is a good way of that, expressing that.
Mm-hmm. Eyes on the prize.
Yeah.
Right.
Go.
I think there's certainly some mornings where you wake up and you're just like, what am I doing?
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay. Like, where you're like, God, today is gonna suck, and this is why. But at the end of the day, you know, like, for me, there's no other choice, right? And so, you know, it was interesting when I was working at Monton, and you know, the whole Top Chef thing happened. I'm running one of the best restaurants, and who knows, whatever. That's open for your opinion. But a really fantastic restaurant. I'm working for Barber, and things just look so perfect. And inside, I was miserable. I was like waking up to go to work every morning. I was like dragging myself there. Not because I didn't love what I was doing and cooking for people, but there was something inside of me that was missing. I wasn't being honest with myself about who I was and am as a person. I think that it's a generic statement, but when you wake up and you're like, okay, and you feel almost settled and excited and happy, you know, the more settled I have become with myself in my personal life, the more settled I am in my professional life. I'm willing to take more chances and mess up a little bit, celebrate my successes and my failures. And therefore, when I'm being better, I'm better to my staff, professional life, friends, family, everything like that. So I just try to avoid that feeling of waking up, always waking up when everything looked perfect, but it really, you know, it really wasn't. So you know, navigating that on a daily basis, many times.
So I opened up the restaurants to. It was like the start of a second career, you know, the culinary thing, and I was in corporate America, and so was my business partner, and we weren't having very much fun, each of us separately in our so we decided to, like, you know, let's do this. This could be fun. Like, you'll cook, I'll run it, let's, you know, I'll take $20 from the register, and I'll go kayaking, you'll make some cute sandwiches, it'll be awesome. And, you know, cut to 8 years later, and we've got three restaurants, and we work 7 days a week, and it's freaking hard. It's the hardest thing ever. So we just try to make sure, literally, not quite every day we check with each other, but like are you still having fun? You know, is it still fun in there somewhere? Because if it's not, and we ask for this, I say ask, but we really demand it for our employees, like, have fun. Because if you're not having fun, your food tastes shitty, your service is terrible, the atmosphere is heavy, it's got to be fun in there somewhere. So it sounds hollow, but that really is the litmus test. We kind of like recalibrate very frequently to make sure that we're still having a good time. Because if we're not, like, get out. It's way too hard, you know?
Then why are you doing it?
Yeah, it's way, way too hard.
It's great. Great answer. Great. Questions from the audience. Wait, this has been amazing. Good energy. This me now.
I kind of have a question. Because we were talking a little bit about, like, the redundancy of this conversation, like women in the kitchen, and it's kind of the same conversation. Does anybody have, like, an idea of where they believe that the conversation should shift?
I think it's like what we said earlier, that, you know, a lot of us, I had stopped saying yes to panels like this for a little while, but I think the things that have happened over the past few weeks, I feel like there is a reason to have panels like this now and bring women together and just talk about what's going on, share our stories, and realize that there are things that are unique to women in this industry, and if we don't speak up and talk about it, change just won't happen. So...
Yes, you're in the blue.
So my question is more about hiring. How do you find good cooks? What are the challenges that you face in finding them? And you know, what do you go through in deciding who you want to hire in your process?
I hire people all the time. We sort of go backwards. Well, I can tell you what we did. We have like a 90-day trial period because, you know, yeah, we check your social media page, make sure you're not just insane, and then we look at your resume. And like, but we feel like if you walk in the door trying to cook, you should cook. I mean, we even stop staging because it's like, you better be able to cook, right? So, okay, let's start there. And then we have this 90-day period where we date you and you date us. And do you like us? Do we like you? We're not sure. But also during that 90 days, we're like, hey, we know you really want to be a cook, but you're probably a better server. Or whatever the case may be. So we sort of work backwards from the individual because it's hard to find people who are kind and honest and who will bust their asses day after day. If you find that and they don't also happen to be a great cook, you should probably find a better place for them to work in your company. So it's less about the job opening and more about we need another team member. That's what we're really looking for, is like somebody who's never lies and works really hard.
Yeah. I think even if you don't know how to, like, so I think especially this day and age, you just hire.
Yeah.
You bring them all in and then you start weeding them out. And Barbara was always, when I was at Montfort, she said, listen, and she was like, hire the one that you want to be, like, that you find to be your friend in the right of, like, being kind and being a good human. She was like, Barbara, I mean, this is Barbara because she's amazing. I can teach anybody how to cook, but I can't teach every person.
Yeah. Right.
And so that's where I lead from. I'm like, as long as you're willing to work hard and do what you want to do, I will give you my time and I will teach you everything I know. And that only works out for both parties.
Right.
Yes, you're in the front.
I have two questions, one for everyone and the other for Carrie. First is, how do you keep yourself from burning out?
That's easy, we don't.
And like the flip side to that is, how do you keep yourself motivated and inspired every day? And then my second question is, do you have any advice for young women like myself who are in college or working, who see themselves kind of morphing their passions together, whether it be fashion and journalism or fashion and food?
The great thing is that you live in the age that you live in, because you've got blogs, you've got social media. It used to be if you had a passion, you just sort of did it, you know, in your own time, hobbies or whatever. But I think now there are so many ways to sort of blend the things you love and put it out into the universe. I hire people off Instagram all the time. Like this one woman left like the most hilarious comments on all our posts, and she just killed me. And I was so happy, like when I would see her post, and I finally DM'd her, and I said, "Do you ever want to write a story for us?" And she said, "Oh my God, that's my dream. I work at the cheese counter at Whole Foods in Chicago." So she wrote a story for us, and now she's like in a graduate writing program.
That's
I have
awesome.
Nothing to do with that part, but. But we hire photographers off Instagram. I've hired people based on their blogs. So like, I think it's, if you have a passion, don't be afraid not to put it out there. But I also think one of the very interesting things about food right now is that a lot of women, especially young women, have combined their passions with food and sort of found their own way into this industry. Food stylists, photographers, writers, like recipe developers, all these people, I'm so amazed at, you know, what, or even like the woman who makes the things out of Rice Krispie treats, Mr. Krispie, you've probably seen her stuff out there. So it's just crazy how many people are just funneling their creativity through food. So just do it and put it out there. I mean, that's the biggest advice. I hope that's helpful.
No, she asked about burnout.
Oh, that's right. That's true.
Yeah, we're bad at that.
I literally walked in and I saw Carrie. I was like, I feel like I've been hit by a bus.
Right.
This is the third time we've seen each other this week. Too,
yeah.
So we're
New York and out here. Especially like book tour and stuff, and just working in kitchens, you're just like, holy shit. But I will say, I thrive off of this weird adrenaline thing. I kind of like it. I'm not gonna lie. And it will probably catch up with me one day, but. I just take my moments where I can. Like, I feel like you have, like, I'm all about taking everything that I can and dumping up, like, all of me into it. And that fills me up, even though I might be physically exhausted.
Yeah. Physically exhausted, the norm.
We're all tired.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and like clockwork, it's like 10 days. It's about 10 days when, like, no one's jokes are funny anymore, and I'm just like, you know, everything is annoying, and I'm like super tired, and that's when I know it's time for some Netflix, a little binge watching, maybe some Kardashians, some TikToks. Don't answer the phone. Don't, you know what I mean?
Self-care.
Yeah, it's just really awful behavior, but yeah.
Right, and I think we have time for one more.
I just wanted to make a comment about the cookbooks. I'm an avid collector. I own almost 500. But as a person who has a large stack of cookbooks on the other side of her bed that she reads at night, I would encourage you to tell your editor to let people tell their story, because I feel like you learn the most from a person that's trying to share with you when they share a little of themselves and their story, and you're more likely to get involved in the book and to pick it up and to cook from it.
We shoehorned 100 stories in there, so I think
One of my favorite cookbooks is Edna Lewis's A Taste of Country Cooking, and it's a stunning book. I mean, if you're never going to cook a day in your life, you should just read it. Edna Lewis's A Taste of Country Cooking.
Oh yes.
Are you a Lori Colvin fan?
I'm sorry.
Lori Colvin. It's spelled L-A-U-R-I-E and C-O-L-W-I-N. She passed away young, tragically, but I borrow a little bit from her books in putting our book together, but she would write essays and weave the recipes and the story about the recipe all through the essay, and they're just beautiful and warm and wonderful and sort of like everything you want, food and storytelling, and you can find used copies all over the place of those books.
And that is the perfect segue, because these two ladies will be signing upstairs directly after this talk. Thank you so much.
How about that? Wasn't it great? Oh my God. Like I said, it's all a blur. It was actually kind of, I'm glad I taped it, because it was neat to listen back. I plan on using it as notes for my next moderated panel. I want to get better at this. this is only maybe my second or third time doing it. So it's something I'm learning. I would like to do it. I'd like to have more live events with these kinds of interviews, maybe with some Charlottesville chefs. What do you think? Is that a good idea? Maybe we could find a space in town and have some cocktails and beer and snacks and talk. Let me know what you think. The one question I wish I had asked. Jessica Wilson came up to me afterwards and said that it occurred to her too late that we should talk about working in all female kitchens or all female work environments. I have worked in an all female work environment, and you know, it's not always a kumbaya experience. Women can be bitchy. They really can. And I wish we had addressed that in this talk, but that, you know what? That'll be for next time. Next time, I'm sure, like Carrie said in the conversation, in this environment that we find ourselves in this world we live in, this new world order, women in food panels seem like they're tired and old and maybe should go by the wayside, but maybe not yet. Maybe we need to talk about it a little bit more, because there are some dudes out there that still just don't get it. Okay, enough of that. I enjoyed talking with all of these women, and particularly at the end, Jessica Wilson and Joy Crump and I had a bit of a longer conversation, so cross your fingers. I'm going to try and get them on the podcast here, because I think we need to continue this conversation and talk about how they run their kitchens. I found them both so very fascinating. And yes, the conversation continued after the recorder went off. Okay, next up, oh my God, this is a special, fabulous episode, and I cannot wait for you to hear it. It is another ambient recording, the third annual Virginia Wine Dinner with Ian Bowden of The Shack that happened at Caramont Farm, with Gail Hobbs Page and her fabulous team of goat herders and goat cheese makers. This happened a few weeks ago, the beginning of November. Or was it the end of October? Oh my God, the dates are all running together. It was in the fall. The weather was beautiful. There are crickets. There are chickens. There's a blacksmith. Corey Blanc of Blanc Creatives was there. I ran into Vu. I hadn't seen him in so long. Oh my God. I ran into so many old friends. Sarah Aducci was there. She's been on the podcast. It was an event by the community for the community. And I'm feeling so grateful for all of the benchmarks that I have reached and the goals and the dreams that I have fulfilled with this podcast. So what a perfect episode for Thanksgiving. By the community, for the community. We sat around farm tables and broke bread and talked and ate, and it was wonderful. I hope you enjoy it. Look for that in 2 weeks. It will air on Thanksgiving Day. Thank you so much for being my guest today. Thank you to Teej.fm, to my sponsors at patreon.com/audaciouspod. As always, you can find me at iTunes. The website is audacious.co. Send me your comments. I dare you to submit a review. What am I doing right? What am I doing wrong? Maybe I will read it on the air. Submit a review. I triple dog dare ya. And until next time, I'm Janae Libby of Audacious Food Talk for Gluttons. I am ferocious, always loquacious, very gracious. And when it comes to learning about food and keeping the connections going and building that community to be ever stronger and learning about all the experiences of women in food, I'm audacious. And I hope you are too. See you in 2 weeks. Big love, big love, big love.